And that's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. And the voice report this week is mostly recovered.
Intact.
Only partly froggy.
Today is Tuesday as we are taping this, and this morning they announced the Oscar nominations. So, as we are required to do by law, we will be talking about the Oscar nominations. After that, we're going to talk about, you know how sometimes you like something and everybody else likes it too, but you like it for your own distinct reason. You're still right, but you're right for a special reason that makes you a unique snowflake. Mm-hmm. We're going to be all cool like that and talk about things that we like for different reasons than most people. And as always, we will finish up the show with what is making us happy this week. Before we get going, let's introduce everybody around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
Well, I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I am the movies editor at NPR.org.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, it's great to see everybody on Oscar Nomination Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God.
Yay!
It was an August occasion for us together.
Now, as some of you may know, there were 9 nominees this morning for Best Picture.
Yeah, seriously, what is... I seriously thought there were going to be like 5 or 6.
Right. It used to be 5 mm-hmm. until a couple years ago.
And then it was 10.
Then it was 10.
Because of the Dark Knight.
Because of the Dark Knight, it was 10. Mm-hmm. Then they changed the rules again, and here's how it worked this year.
Okay.
There could be up to 10.
Mm-hmm. But no fewer than 5.
No fewer than 5.
Correct.
Up to 10.
3 is right out.
In order, 3 is the number of the counting. The threshold, as I understand it, was that your movie, in order to be nominated for Best Picture, I mean, they took the top 10, and it was a weighted voting system.
Yes.
Such that being named first was super important, and there was a threshold.
Yes, you have to get over 5%.
5% of the people voting had to make you number one.
And somehow, 9 different movies were named the best movie of the year by
5%
of the Academy
and
voters.
And one of them was extremely loud and incredibly close.
Yes,
and
no
another
one
was War Horse.
No one really understands.
That's how it happened. Clearly, the opinions about what was the actual best movie of the year failed to coalesce around any one movie, or this could not possibly have happened.
What's so weird to me is it feels to me like going into this process, it felt like the opinion had coalesced around 3 movies, which were Hugo, The Artist, and The Descendants.
Right.
And so I was certain that there were going to be maybe 6, at the outside, guess 7.
Right. But you have to remember, part of what happened, I think, with Best Picture is that if you take a movie like The Tree of Life,
right,
okay,
which is very polarizing, that one I understood.
The Tree of Life is one where if you like it, you have never seen anything that you think even remotely approaches it. If you bought into that cosmic ballet in the middle of that movie...
I thought you were going to say a different word that starts with B.
If you bought into the cosmic ballet in the middle of that movie, then you are shocked by it, and it is your number one movie. I think it was very unusual for Tree of Life to be like your 6th favorite movie of the year.
Sure.
Like, if you love that movie, then that's going to be like your favorite movie. So before we get too incredibly ahead of ourselves...
Because I do have more opinions.
The 9 nominees are The Artist, which is the black and white silent.
Which will win.
Which Stephen thinks will win. The Descendants with George Clooney. Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. The Surprise nominee, which is a 9/11 tearjerker, essentially, which has Tom Hanks.
As opposed to
Sandra
a 9/11
Bullock.
Romp.
Right.
An animated comedy.
Right. The Help from the much-loved novel.
Ugh.
Hugo, which is the Martin Scorsese.
Which could
another
win.
Another salute to cinema. Midnight in Paris, the obligatory Woody Allen.
Oh, please. Mm-hmm. Whose favorite movie is that?
It's a very charming film.
5%.
Sure.
Here's the one that surprises me. Moneyball.
Yeah.
I am actually more surprised by Moneyball than I am by Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close.
Really?
Because Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, I saw that movie, and whatever anybody else tells you about it, it is effective. People will say, I hated it, but I cried.
Well, I guarantee you I'm going to cry at that movie.
Find that kind of cathartic experience of crying to be really satisfying. It's a little kid. It's very manipulative. It is
right.
very manipulative.
Well, it's 9/11.
But
right.
what I'm saying is there are people who really like that kind of thing. The people
and it
who
can
like
still
to
be a sturdy piece of filmmaking.
Who like Tom Hanks, who like Sandra Bullock, who like Max von Sydow.
Sydow.
Those people are going to love that movie, and that doesn't surprise me.
I bawled my eyes out at The Descendants. Now I'm an easy mark. I cried at Hop.
Moneyball is a solid Hollywood Brad Pitt starring movie. But the idea that it would be your favorite movie of the year, to me, it's like if your favorite TV show was like CSI, and you felt like that was the absolute best show on television, and you fancied yourself a person who knows a lot about television. I'm not saying it can't be CSI, people. Please don't come for me. I'm saying it surprises me that award nominators, that 5% of the people voting would say, my favorite movie of the whole year was Moneyball.
Right. Well, better that than one of the two remaining things that we have not discussed. We stopped right before we got to Tree of Life.
Tree of Life.
And War Horse.
Do it, Glenn. Do it, Glenn.
A horse made for war.
It's my horse.
And I haven't seen War Horse, so I have absolutely no opinion of the movie. The two I have not seen are War Horse and Midnight in Paris. God, I don't want to see the movie.
You'll like it more than you think.
I am not a Woody Allen person, but anyway, War Horse I only know as, and I also didn't see the stage show, but I only know it as a play.
Yeah.
Who stars as the horse?
Jimmy Fallon.
Large ball of wicker.
The entire draw was this incredibly inventive puppetry that they did to create the horse, and that was sort of the big thing everybody talked about. It's like if you started from the Broadway production of The Lion King, right, which had all the puppet animals, and you said, we made that into a movie, and instead of the puppets, we have real animals. And you were like, okay. I mean, War Horse, for me, I did not understand the transition from play to film.
Yeah.
We can make some predictions about not necessarily who's going to win, but what the Oscars are going to be like this year.
Yes, take it away.
Extremely loud and incredibly close.
I am waiting
and
for
Billy
Crystal.
I had two different people today on Twitter offer me the idea that Hazanavicius, I'm going to call him, the director of The Artist, would be saluted with a Hava Nagila
song. Oh, let us hope. Let us hope.
That is what Twitter is for.
Independently.
The Oscars, which are about self-congratulation and aren't we great?
Anyway.
Isn't what we do important? The fact that both Hugo and The Artist are nominated, which means we're going to be getting a lot of Oscar presentations, which sound a lot like...
The movies are an art.
The Alone in the Dark.
Right.
Dreams spun from light.
Dear God.
Best award, the award for best cinematography goes to. It's going to be a lot of that hushed, reverent tones.
But it's like a child sits in a theater in the dark.
Exactly. We are the storytellers. We're better than you. That's going to be the subtext of the entire evening.
But it's always kind of like that.
It's going to, I'm just going to say there's going to be a whole thing about it. I'm just grateful that Super 8 didn't make it in, because then it would have just been unbearable.
But Super 8's so good.
I like Super 8. You be quiet. So moving on from Best Picture, here's my favorite nomination. What was my prediction for 2012?
I know.
And Trey was wrong.
I was totally wrong.
My prediction for 2012, Melissa McCarthy, Best Supporting Actress for Bridesmaids, and I win because I am smart.
Yes, but we didn't predict Kristen Wiig, did you?
For the screenplay, yes.
You did?
No, I didn't. I didn't. But I'm saying she was not nominated as, for acting, just for screenplay. But now with screenplays, there's a little more wiggle room because you have five adapted and five original. So there's a little more, play in the joints. You wind up having 10 that are nominated. But at the same time, I was surprised by that.
I think of the screenplay category I always have as the movie Glenn likes, and the other categories, the best picture category, as like stuff that's not for Glenn. All the kind of cool stuff that will never get nominated for best picture ends up in either adapted screenplay or screenplay.
Which is funny, because I always think of what wins best screenplay as the best picture of the year that will not win best picture.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right. I think you're saying the same thing. But this year, Glenn, though, that would leave you with The Ides of March.
Yeah.
Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, which maybe you like. Margin Call.
Yeah, I didn't care for that so much.
Oh, it was that sound?
That was a Trey sound.
That was a Trey sound in defense of Margin Call.
I was going to say, I think it was the Zachary Quinto sound, if I'm not mistaken. Or A Separation, which I have not seen, but which I've heard is
heard
very
good. Great thing.
Well, I think what you're talking about happened more when there would be like five, and then there would be 10 best screenplay.
Right.
So like people like the Coen brothers would get best picture nominations, but like that stuff would always like sneak in there. Like,
there are several years where the Coen brothers owned the screenplay and then got nothing else.
Right.
And that's kind of what I'm talking about. I mean, and the fact that Bridesmaid did get nominated, that's kind of the catch-all place where stuff that doesn't get nominated for the big best picture, though, is kind of...
Right. There were definitely a couple movies that were pretty much left out altogether that were surprises, or at least the people expected might show up for certain things, like Drive, Shame,
right.
Which I think everybody thought Michael Fassbender was a shoe in, shall we say?
He was a hard no way.
No, I don't know what we're going for there. But Michael Fassbender, Shame got completely blanked.
Yep.
Melancholia,
completely
Lars
wiped
von Trier,
out.
Completely wiped out.
We need to talk about Kevin.
We need to talk about Kevin.
Did Tilda Swinton not get
nominated? No.
Nope. Apparently we don't.
I don't have to rush out and see it.
Lesson of the week: Oscars don't like dark when there's something else to talk about.
But I got to admit, though, I have mixed feelings about it, and it definitely seemed to me like a movie that was willed into existence to win awards, and specifically to win awards for her. Many movies are like that, but I felt a little bludgeoned by it in a few ways, and one of them was you shall nominate Tilda Swinton.
Yeah.
Damn it.
Yeah.
She's been nominated
for basically everything else she's ever been in.
She's excellent in it. But the movie wore on me. I got to admit. Now that's not to say that Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close didn't, because that movie also wore on me.
But those three films, Melancholia and Shame, and We Need to Talk About Kevin,
and Drive,
all shut out. What didn't get shut out?
Kung Fu Panda 2. Kung Fu Panda 2.
Also, W.E. has a nomination. None of those films did.
But not for song.
No. Surprising that.
Yeah, yeah.
Wait, who did get nominated for song?
Two things.
Muppets.
Sure.
Muppets and Rio.
Yeah. Yep.
Two things. Rio. Two nominees. Yep. Please explain.
Instead of having a bunch of votes, and then you take the top five or the top three or whatever, everybody assigns all the songs that are submitted a numerical score. And there is a bar that you have to get over in the voting to get nominated. And, for example, if not enough people, I don't remember what it is, I think it might be 8 point something. And if not enough people give you a score over 8 point whatever, if your average score isn't that high, you're not nominated. Mm-hmm. If only one scores over the bar, then you get two nominees.
You get that one and whatever
the next movie is, so that there's a competition. Mm. If none of them go over, then there are no nominees.
Okay. One more thing that I thought was interesting. Remind me, did Tintin win Golden Globes?
Yes.
Okay.
And it was not nominated.
Shut out. Take that, foreigners. With your foreign ways and your foreign cartoons.
Yeah. One of the first things I noticed, and it wasn't a huge surprise, but Cars 2 from Pixar, the first Pixar movie since they instituted Best Animated Feature, not to be nominated for Best Animated Feature. And many of them, not all of them, but many of them have won, but it was not even nominated. And I don't think it needed to be nominated, although I haven't seen very many of those animated
movies.
Rango absolutely deserves to be in there.
Yeah.
Compared to Puss in Boots.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I sort of felt like that's got to hurt if you're Pixar.
Lose to Puss in Boots.
It's one thing to lose to Kung Fu Panda 2.
Which is awesome.
We might have to have a Rango versus Kung Fu Panda 2 off hair.
Yeah. Nice.
I think we should also mention documentary, because there were some surprising shoutouts there. Mm-hmm.
There were. I have advocated for a bunch of documentaries on this podcast
none of which were nominated.
None of them are nominated. I really thought that Bill Cunningham New York was a shoe.
Which I watched over the weekend, figuring I would get a jump start on talking about the Oscars.
Did you like it?
I thought it was delightful.
Yeah, it's a
small movie,
right? But it's a lovely movie, and many documentaries are small.
Right.
I felt like that one was the closest thing to a shoe-in. That or Project Nim, which is from the guy who did Man on Wire, and it's about a chimp, and it's like,
it's
about a chimp.
How does that not get an Oscar?
And we all remember when Dunstan checks in.
Exactly, and I am glad that there will not be
The Planet of the Apes, where's that? Nowhere.
I am glad there won't be a Billy Crystal introduction of Project Nim, because I don't need that in my life.
Paradise Lost 3, that's going to win,
two,
I assume, right?
That's a good question.
I think there's a lot of love for Pina.
There's a lot of love for Pino, which I haven't seen.
To rally around a big political issue.
Yeah.
To sort of say, like, Hollywood...
Hollywood made a difference.
There are two things about Paradise Lost 3 that I think pull in opposite directions.
Sequels are always really bad.
This is the third documentary in a series of films that have been made about, as you probably know, about the West Memphis three guys who went to jail in, I believe, 1994. They were convicted in 1994, had been in jail before that, but were just released this past year under a sort of complex and somewhat troubling plea deal. But
in part due to the influence of those first
in
two
part
films.
Due to the influence of these films, and in fact their release had to be added to this movie after it had screened at a couple of festivals. The thing I think operates in its favor is it has this very palpable effect, which it's very difficult to prove with most documentaries, that they have palpably affected what has become of their subject matter. It's not like people can be like, hey, an inconvenient truth, and now the Earth's not warming anymore. Like, it's like, if I am understanding the politics correctly, Paradise Lost 3 is among the films made largely for television and really created by HBO, which qualifies through a theatrical run, which only lasts a short time and is not really a big part of its history. And I think this is actually the kind of documentary they're getting at when they change the rules to make it harder for films to qualify that way, which they're doing for next year. Right now, it's only the documentary branch votes for Best Documentary Feature, as I understand it. If that's the case, then if they're mad about this movie sneaking its way into the nominations to begin with, you may get a bunch of people who say, I want to give it to a documentary that played more theatrically.
Oh, see, and this is the kind of Oscar politics that drives me bonkers.
Me too. Yeah. But you know, the ones that made some money in theaters, there's a terrific movie called Buck that I've talked about before, about the sort of, they call him the real life horse whisperer, which is a delightful movie and actually made a decent showing in theaters. That didn't get nominated. So it's like, now you're down to a couple of these things. There is a documentary called If a Tree Falls, A Story of the Earth Liberation Front that I have seen, but I saw on home video. I have no idea whether it played in theaters very much or not. I believe it was at Silver Docks. People see most documentaries on home video.
How many of us saw Bill Cunningham New York on something other than Netflix streaming?
Of course. Yeah, I think the possibility exists that the one thing that could pull against Paradise Lost, which otherwise has all this remarkable momentum and reason for people to be really admiring of it, is that those politics of TV versus theater, which they're mad about enough to change the rules, so they care about it.
But it's Oscar's eternal war, snobbery versus self-congratulation.
Of course.
I think self-congratulation wins out.
That should be the subtitle.
One of the things that really bummed me out, I said back when I was at Silver Docks, I said, the only thing I want out of this experience is I want something to be nominated for the Oscar that I can be like, oh yeah, I saw that back at the festival in the summer. Didn't happen. I saw 23 movies,
Boo.
Several of which made it all the way to the shortlist.
Boo Academy.
Did they get on there? No. I got skunked.
I would like to point out that NPR does have reviews of two of the five documentary features ready for your perusal at NPR.org. Those are Pina. And To Hell and Back Again.
I just want to point out that you saw 23 movies hoping that one of them would be nominated for the Oscar. None of them were. You know what was nominated for an Oscar? Real Steel.
That's true.
It totally was.
I did see, I am ahead of the game because I saw Real Steel. And you know, now all I got to see to polish off the technical categories is Transformers.
Yeah.
Rise of whatever that is.
Turn off the dark.
So you can find the full list, as I said, on our site. And, you know, stay with us. And obviously, as the Oscars get closer, I'm sure we will revisit this after we force everyone at gunpoint to see all of the remaining
movies. All four of us see all nine movies.
No. I will see all the adapted screenplays and all the screenplay ones.
I will see all nine of your Best Picture nominations.
I hereby pledge once again to probably not.
All I got left is War Horse and Woody Allen. I don't know which one I want to clean up after last, but
we will talk about the Woody Allen one. I have some strong opinions about that, but not now.
Yeah, we will definitely. I promise to see it, so we'll get back to that. And you can come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH, or find us on the blog at Monkey C, and talk to us about it some more. So those are your Oscar nominations. Now, perhaps when you listened to some of those Oscar nominations, you thought that movie that they nominated for Best Picture, I liked that movie. And maybe in the age of Twitter and contrarians and arguing and everybody talking about snubs and this and that, perhaps you felt lonely. Perhaps you felt like, is it not okay for me to say, that thing they nominated for Best Picture, I thought that was pretty good. We hear you. We understand. And what we were going to talk about, and I believe we originally called this Contrarians Be Damned, or Out on a Very Sturdy Limb. So we want to take the opportunity to talk about something that we like, in addition to the everybody else perhaps likes it, and we like it too. Maybe we like it for a different reason. Maybe we just want to reiterate why we think it's so good.
Or maybe our way is better.
Or maybe our way is better. Lest everything get grabbed up in a sea of, well, of course you like the artist. Everybody likes the artist. That's why it was Best Picture nominated, right? We may still want to talk about it. So that's what we thought we would tackle today. Glenn Weldon, talk to me.
Last summer, a film came out, pretty soon. Small film, a low-budget science fiction film that got a very small release, but it did pretty well with critics. I am talking about Attack the Block. It was actually pretty well received by critics. It's got a 75 Metacritic score. They called it things like scrappy and clever and witty and riveting. But few of the reviews I read mentioned the thing about the movie, which makes it remarkable. A handful of them did, and I have a couple examples. The first of a person who really didn't get what made this film remarkable. This is the San Francisco Chronicle. I'm just going to read from it briefly. Some unsolicited advice. If you're going to show people imperiled by aliens, make us care whether these people live or die. Or at the very least, don't make your audience actively root for the aliens by showing your ostensible heroes mugging a young woman at knife point in the movie's first scene. I imagine you must think I'm exaggerating, but no. The characters we're expected to engage with, the people for whom our rooting interest is simply assumed, are violent street thugs. Sorry, I'm with the aliens on this one. Okay, ignore the condescension, if you can. Ignore the way he kind of refuses to engage the movie in any meaningful way. What he's talking about is actually what the film's about, which is this trusting the audience to have two simultaneous opinions at the same time, not dictating to the audience how they should feel. A central moral ambiguity, which is what the whole film's about. Somebody else who reviewed it for the Washington Post, not the actual Washington Post, the daily Washington Post, but the weekend one, because it didn't merit an interview in the Washington Post. His name is John DeFore, and what he said is right on. He said, if this film were a Hollywood screenplay, what would happen is, and again, the first scene of the film, a nurse is walking home. She gets accosted by very young street thugs at knife point. In the middle of the mugging, alien crashes to Earth, and if a Hollywood filmmaker made this film, the alien would leap out and kill the evil street thugs, because that's what Hollywood films do. They reinforce our notions of right and wrong. They congratulate us for feeling the way we do, which I would argue is not the province of art. It's the province of propaganda. But leave that aside for a second. What this film proceeds to do is to deal with these characters as people, not ideas. And the relationship between the nurse and these kids never gets simplified. It never gets backed away from. It remains complicated, because that's kind of what would happen if you were attacked by aliens.
Says you.
Yeah, you get together. So this film, when it came out, was compared a lot to Cowboys and Aliens, only because it came out at the same time and they were aliens. It shouldn't have been compared to that movie. What it should have been compared to was another film that came out relatively at the same time called Super 8. And when I saw Super 8, just between you and me, because it's about kids and aliens, when I saw Super 8, it wasn't for me. You know, I didn't hate it, but it just, you know, thought the whole thing with the locket was way too movie making by numbers.
Sorry.
After seeing this film, I now have reconsidered what I thought of Super 8, which is a bloated, self-indulgent, schmaltzy exercise in a kind of pointless narcissism, which is so far up Steven Spielberg's butt it could have screened for polyps.
Wow.
Did you guys see Attack the Block?
No.
No, but it's not as good as Super 8.
I'm not seeing it now.
It's so good.
Lost the room, man.
It's so good.
The room has turned on you.
I totally.
No. Coach Taylor's in Super 8.
I know he is. It's kind of hard to. It's kind of hard to miss. I'm just telling you that this is interesting, challenging, fun filmmaking, as opposed to something that tells you exactly what you already know.
All right.
I'd rather watch a new film than a film that has already been made.
All right, well, we're just going to move on before there's a fist fight. Trey Graham?
I'm going to take the I like this for a different reason approach.
Okay.
And I'm going to say that, you know, Stephen Thompson is widely admired, but but most people like him because he's kind of the court jester of NPR, right? Whereas I like him because his hair smells so good.
Oh, God.
This is taking a turn.
This is not what you wanted out of this segment.
I feel uncomfortable in, like, seven different ways.
Because, first of all, widely admired.
I lied.
Really?
Yeah, I know. No, I lied. I'm actually going to... I want to talk about Tilda Swinton. Which we did a little bit, so I won't go on at great length. I don't want to talk about her because of Michael Clayton, or we need to talk about Kevin, or The Deep End, or anything else from the last decade. I want to talk about a film called Edward II, which is Derek Jarman's adaptation of the Christopher Marlowe play.
Never heard of it.
Very strange.
I don't like it.
I think it's from 1991. Very, very
1991.
Arty, very experimental. She plays the Queen of England, Queen Isabella, who's originally French, but she's married into the British royal family. And her husband has a thing for one of his courtiers, a guy named Gaveston. And Queen Isabella, spoiler from this, you know, about this play from the 15th, 16th century, will actually destroy them in the end. So you do eventually get one of Tilda Swinton's great monstrous women in this film. But there's a part in the middle of the story where the king has been forced by his advisors to banish Gaveston across to Ireland, I believe, and he hasn't come back. The queen has this great monologue of despair, and it's when you discover in the play and in this film that she really loves the king. Part of what's making her participate in the political games and that get Gaveston banished is an actual human feeling. And it's a beautifully played thing. It's very, very small, very contained. But there is, in this film, and in this Swinton performance, a commitment to style and to singularity and strangeness, even, that you've seen in everything she's done since, which is why I love it and why I like to go back and watch it.
Tilda Swinton.
Mm-hmm. Not just for this one thing, but also because she is just a freak of nature in every aspect of her life.
In every good way.
You know, she, in every good way.
Did you see her at the Golden Globes?
I did see her at the Golden Globes, looking like David Bowie.
Oh my gosh.
The thing. When she wants to, she can be as conventionally beautiful and glamorous as Grace Kelly.
Right.
There are angles and hairstyles that make her look like a Hitchcock blonde. Mm-hmm. And then you'll see her walking down the street with the sides of her head shaved, wearing a hefty bag, and 4 feet of mohawk sticking up.
Well, it's like seeing Rooney Mara at an awards show, thinking like, wow, she's gorgeous.
Right,
you have
no
idea that that's the...
This woman put herself in a glass box and lay down in it for a week in an art gallery as a performance piece. I love Tilda Swinton because she is just her.
Right.
She is exactly who she wants to be, and she doesn't give a darn what you think.
Even when she's slumming it, she did in the Keanu Reeves film Constantine.
Yes.
She really classes up the joint. That's what she's there for.
You know, she's playing the Archangel Gabriel, right? And, you know, wearing this weird sort of bondage-y top and a pair of wings.
Roger Ebert did a series of video interviews with her when she's just in her hotel room talking about We Need to Talk About Kevin. And you have this image in your mind of what kind of a cool and patrician and off-putting. And she's really relatable and ferociously intelligent.
About
what she is doing, what she's up to.
Just punishingly smart when you read long interviews with her or watch her talk. And she is actually a patrician. Her family is very, very old and from the landed gentry.
Mm.
Another reason Trey likes her.
Yes.
Stephen Thompson, something that you like that everyone else likes too. How sturdy is your limb? Never mind.
Well...
Boy, sorry about that.
Have you seen Shame?
Oh, boy.
Okay, another heir to an empire.
Mm.
The reason I picked this...
Is it Kung Fu Panda 2?
It is Kung Fu Panda 3, the as-yet unmade...
Dear God.
No, I think that this is a perfect example of someone who is widely celebrated, but I feel like needs to be more among the ranks of legends in people's mind, and I have chosen Rob Reiner.
Really? Hmm.
I don't think of Rob Reiner as... like these living legends that they'll trot out at the Oscars or whatever, a Scorsese.
Oh, no, not at all.
You know, that he's seen as sort of a somewhat of a minor, not minor, but a...
I think he's been seen as very uneven.
Right.
I think that he has certainly done some things that people have really liked.
Maybe more journeyman than artist.
I think a little bit of a journeyman. A little bit of sort of, well, he makes these kind of box office-y pictures.
Right.
Listen to this filmography from the years 1984 to 1995. These are the movies that he has directed in this time. This is saying nothing of All in the Family.
Sure,
this is saying nothing of anything else. This is Spinal Tap, The Sure Thing,
Woohoo!
Stand By Me, The Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, Misery, A Few Good Men, North, The American President.
You have a good point.
I only included North because it gets you to The American President.
North is where I got in trouble. But boy, when you first said Rob Reiner, I was like, but then...
How many great movies does a person
have to make? I think that is a lot of really good movies that, not necessarily like the greatest art of the century, but movies that I have returned to again and again and again
Of the 9 movies that I've listed, how many times have you watched one of those movies?
A lot.
Like,
I will tell you, you're right.
15 times for this movie, 10 times for this time. Every time this movie is on cable, I watch it again and again.
Well, and I've seen The Sure Thing about 90 times, so I'm off the curve.
Right. And I don't watch a crazy, crazy amount of movies, and I've watched those movies a bunch of times.
Well, just between The Princess Bride and Spinal Tap, When Harry Met Sally, and I mean,
Misery is such a good
Misery
movie.
Misery is a good movie. I loved A Few Good Men for a long time. I watch it as much as I.
There are parts of it that obviously have gone over.
American President's really charming. Yeah, you win me over with this list.
That's an amazing, amazing, amazing stretch of movies. Part of why I thought of this is I just got a chance to watch Princess Bride with the kids, and what struck me watching it for the umpteenth time, but with my kids, is there is not a second of that movie that I would change.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say, because people listening to the podcast will be thinking, he has also made some stinkeroos, sort of later in his career.
Well, here's his later filmography after that.
Right.
Ghosts of Mississippi, The Story of Us, Alex and Emma, Rumor Has It, The Bucket List,
Yeah, he went off the rails at some point, but the stretch that you named, I think, deserves whatever praise you want to heap upon it.
I read a big article about, the 25th anniversary of The Princess Bride, and they were talking about a bunch of the people who are in the movie, and there was a long interview with Billy Crystal, and Billy Crystal was talking about all the amazing riffs that he had just written joke after joke, and you think that scene's funny? You should see all the jokes that are left on the cutting room floor, and he proceeds to recite horrible joke after fart joke after poop joke after... Yeah. Colonic joke after whatever, and you're just like, Rob Reiner, genius.
Yeah, and I said, The Sure Thing and Stand By Me, but Stand By Me is another one that I watched not that long ago and had sort of that revelation of like, wow, I really loved this movie, and I forgot all about how much I loved this movie.
And understand, I mean, you look at those movies, several of those movies were Oscar nominated and whatever, but I mean, how many of those movies, they may not be the best movies of those years, but how many of them are your favorite movies?
He made a run of incredibly durable, likable movies. I will agree with that.
There you go.
Yeah. But that's big.
Likeable. Yeah, it is.
But I often say the most underrated emotion is like.
Yeah.
that love is masquerades as a lot of other things, but like is kind of this, is sturdier and more real.
Yep.
So let's all erect a statue to Rob Reiner in our hearts.
Very good. Very good. I will go along with you based entirely on your argument. You have persuaded me with words. Here's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about the X-Files, and I'll tell you why. Here's who I was watching the X-Files, and I speak here about real X-Files, which is the part up until David Duchovny left, all that. I really, really liked The X-Files. It was a show my sister loved that I wasn't originally into that I gradually got into. I always felt it was so incredibly frustratingly reductive that there were so many people who were like, when are they going to kiss? The way that I looked at it was always, they were able to create a relationship between those two characters where they were so close that sleeping together or being romantically involved or being married or having a baby together wouldn't make them any closer than they already were. So I didn't understand why people felt like they wanted to move that relationship along a line toward kissing. If you love that relationship, it was already a soulmate relationship, devoid of romantic involvement of any kind. And I always felt like, it was not the right way to look at that story. And in fact, it was the exact thing I liked about that story, that they created this vision of these two people who were, they were friends, but it was more than that. They were friends, but they were sort of, platonic life partners in this way that made perfect sense to me and that I never felt needed to be like, so now they should have sex. Like, what? So if you want to talk about right reason, wrong reason, wanting them to get together and get married and have babies completely made no sense to me.
I just wanted to be invited to the wedding.
Mm. Yeah.
It's funny. When that show was on the air, I was desperate to know about the mythology. I wanted the answers. There might have been a spreadsheet or two that I might have created. To track the black oil and the way it was, this properties. And I always got really frustrated by the movie, the Monster of the Week ones, because it's like, But why are you investigating a thing in Oregon when there's a thing? How can you?
But some of the Monster of the Week ones.
Now that I know how the mythology ended or didn't or whatever the hell happened there, the ones you go back to, the ones that are really strong, there's an episode called Bad Blood. I don't remember what season it is.
Oh, Bad Blood.
It's such a good, solid piece of comedy and
Bad
action.
Bad Blood,
and funny.
Small Potatoes.
Small Potatoes.
Home.
Josie Chunks from Outer Space. Great.
The Host.
Solid The Host. awesome. And I find when you go back on Netflix streaming, it's like, I'm never going to watch one of those.
Yeah.
Stupid one about the meteor.
Right.
God.
It's, I'm going to go watch home. The, I'm going to go watch the one with the freaks, right?
Yeah,
I'm going to go watch the one with the really, really weird, freaky people.
Yep.
All right. So anyway, so that's my pick.
Good pick.
And now as we move to the final segment of our show, what is making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
The thing that I found making me happy this week came from the Pop Culture Happy Hour Facebook page. There's a video
Facebook.com/PCHH.
That's right. There's a video called Watchin' Downton, which is simple. It's just three women. I want to give their names. Kathy Salerno, Emily Altman, and Abra Tabak.
Okay.
Abra Tabak? That's only 2 minutes long. It's basically exactly that. It's of this genre of people watching something and you watch them as they watch the thing. What is different about this is that they're just watching Downton Abbey. That's all it is. And it's cut, you know, in different ways. So, man, let me tell you, if I was Julian Fellowes, this video would be my crack.
Because
it's one thing to be told that you're doing a good thing and win an award and read
a
review.
Watching people watches.
But watching people, this would be, it'd be the first thing I see in the morning, the last thing would be on my phone, because they are what you get, you might not get from just, you know, I really like your work, is the passion you see. And they do some jokes, but the real thing about this video is the passion that they evince. At one point, they're watching it and you can see them go, "Oh, that's not how you fill a kettle," like that. Because, and then you remember the scene. But the passion they bring to is just fantastic. So check it out. It's called Watchin' Downton.
Very good. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
Well, Man or Muppet has an Oscar nomination, which means that one half of Flight of the Conchords has an Oscar nomination, which is kind of awesome.
That is true.
I am also made somewhat happy by the nomination for Gary Oldman, who has never gotten one before, believe
really?
Me.
Really?
Yeah. So that's a good thing. The thing that's making me giggle a little bit in a happy sort of way is that there's a new Tumblr, I think it is, called Capital Couture, which is devoted to exploring the fashions of the world of the capital city in the Hunger Games, as those images begin to as those images begin to sneak out, and you remember from the books that the capital is so decadent that the, you know, hair,
yes,
skin is painted different various colors, you know, there's lots of nails and the fashion is outrageous. So this has begun, people. I'm sorry, I have
say,
to
it's, you know, have I mentioned my concern about too much hype for the Hunger Games?
Wake me when the movie comes out.
Yep. Yeah.
Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
Just a couple of quick hits, a couple of movies that I saw that I really loved. I mean, I caught up with Bill Cunningham, New York, as we mentioned earlier. Caught up with The Artist, which 1 week earlier I was sort of sneering about, it's going to win Best Picture because of Harvey Weinstein. That is a lovely, lovely, lovely film. We'll get more to that when we talk about the Oscar nominations, nomination by nomination. finally, just have to throw a thank you to my pal Linda Holmes, who this afternoon brought by my desk her friend, who I'm going to manage, fancy friend, brought by Yul Kwan, who those of you listening at home, the like 3% of people who listen to this podcast who are big Survivor nerds, will know was the winner of Survivor Cook Islands and my favorite Survivor of all time. And the embodiment of what I love in these sort of strategy-based reality TV shows, which is somebody who played the game really, really, really smartly in a way that naturally gets underrated. I felt like we had a winner kind of like that in the most recent season, and I just got to geek out for like a half an hour with Holmesy here and with Yul Kwan. Just delighted me to no end.
He's a mensch.
He's a mensch.
He's a good fella. I like him a lot, and it was a pleasure to bring him by your desk. Here's what's making me happy this week. It's very simple. I've already mentioned it a couple times. I'm going to mention it again. It is This Had Oscar Buzz, which is my favorite new Tumblr in the world. It is one of those things where somebody starts a Tumblr and you say, that is the best idea in the world. How did no one already think of it? It's such a perfect time to launch it because this is a Tumblr that was created by my friend Joe Reed, with whom I used to work at Television Without Pity and also was my former roommate in Brooklyn. Basically, it's just movie posters for movies where you think, oh my God, I remember that movie. People thought that was going to be like an award-winning movie, like Captain Corelli's Mandolin. And one of the ones that he added in the last couple of days was Fur, which was the movie about Diane Arbus, and it had Nicole Kidman and Robert Downey Jr. And I looked at it. Mm-hmm. No, I looked at it and I was like, that's exactly right. I remember that movie. And you go through and it's like, Appaloosa.
isn't like
it's movies that are completely forgotten. But if you look at the poster, you think, I remember when people tea with Mussolini, which had Cher.
Yes.
And
oh my God.
You remember them and you realize how ephemeral that idea that you're going to market a movie as something that people are going to love and respect and admire. Simon Birch.
I give you David Duchovny in full frontal.
I'm immediately brought to For Your Consideration, 1492.
Yeah. Right. And it's a perfect moment, not just because it's Oscar nominations, but also because it's Sundance. This is a point where, with movies not even out yet, they haven't even been seen by anyone. Some of them will be recut before they ever see the light of day. There are already people who are like, best picture contender for a year from now. And it's like, you know what? Hold your horses, because this had Oscar buzz. And I was telling Joe on Twitter last night, it's my new dismissive insult. Like, oh, her? Yeah, she had Oscar buzz. Yeah, oh, that job? That job had Oscar buzz. And it feels good to say. It's a bunch of awesome, colorful, cool-looking movie posters. And, as I said, it is the most rewarding feeling in the world, which is recognition and memory of something that you truly have not thought about in years.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my, I remember Captain Corelli's mandolin. So this had Oscar buzz.
Summersby.
Summersby is on there. Summersby is
on
there.
Yes, I'm looking at it right now.
And his little line under it is, I never had Oscar buzz like I had with you. So this had Oscar buzz, my favorite new Tumblr by a mile. And that is what's making me happy this week. And that is the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham, like the graham crackers that you eat before you see the Oscars. Glenn, you can follow Glenn. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. We are helped, as always, by our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff. You can follow Mike at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. The music you are hearing is from Mike's band, Hello Come In. They provide that to us, and we are eternally grateful. So thanks to all of you guys for coming by on Oscar Tuesday.
Wouldn't miss it.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.